question really is, I mean, I really like the analysis of the problem globally. Is there any reason why that analysis wouldn't also apply and the solutions apply domestically as well? And that's
So the problems and the pressures coming down are the same. And then what you need to look at on the other side is, what's the protections? And the protections that we had in the UK, it seems to me, being undermined. But that's not my area of expertise. That, it seems to me, is an area for other people. What you've got overseas is that there is no free access to medical care. There is no housing benefit. People are absolutely destitute if you cannot make money out of that day work that you are doing. But in terms of the pressures and the structures of the food supply chain, it's common. The difference is in the protections.
I think there is a difference in the sense that in the UK we do have a system of justice in different areas. And you know, I gave one example of the, you know, the Game Masters Licensing Authority, which came in to try and sort of deal with some of these issues, and it does have some teeth. You know, it can prosecute people. Mm-hmm. And we have other, regulation like race relations, equality law, and you know, all of these are instruments that are there that can be used. But clearly, we can see just the, you know, how tough this issue is, and even though we have quite anything advanced, you know, set of regulatory and policy instruments to deal with these different issues, you know, they're still going on. So part of it is also, which is harder, is probably also a cultural change. And that's why, you know, I put up at the end this question, you know, what is a decent job? You know, what do we mean by, you know, sort of a good job? And I think sort of, if we could also need to perhaps make more of the business case, and even food industry bodies do this, showing how by improving skills and training and essentially, you know, sort of making the quality of your job, even from the lowest level down, improving that, you know, in terms of personal skills and an ability to progress or to engage with your job, you know, that can have a sort of a positive output as well, because it then comes down to, you know, showing that there can be some money involved in this. You know, better employees, you know, produce more.
Can I push back and say, if the whole point of retailers and the supply chain is to push the risks and the costs out, then that's all dealing with symptoms, not cause.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's why I emphasise that, I think we have to sort of, you know, focus on some of the structural issues within the food supply chain and where the linkages are, because often, particularly when you talk about sort of exploitation of the workers, say in fruit or vegetable picking, it tends to be the focus on individualized, you know, criminal activity. Now that is a problem, but you know, why is that sort of, you know what is in a sense creating that sort of area in which, you know, criminals can, you know, organized crime can move into. So I'm not trying to downplay that there is a structural issue there. But some companies, and we were talking about this beforehand, and perhaps I'm slightly more optimistic, but only slightly though. Some companies have engaged, are engaging with this problem in terms of in their wider social responsibility agendas and how they see the sustainability of their businesses, and also in trying to manage the risks in their supply chain. And so there has been, perhaps in the past 10 years, 5 years, you know, some slow change in recognition, and part of that is engaging, you know, with your workforce. And so some of these big players, I mean, that's why I talk about the structure of the food supply chain, you know, some of these big companies are changed. You know, when they make a change, it has, it sort of creates ruptures throughout, you know, on different supply chains. But it's hugely problematic, you know, and there's examples we could give, you know, to show how difficult this is.
I'm not sure if I could formulate this exactly as a question, but the area I'd like to explore is
the relationship between low pay and migrant workers specifically. Is there a cause and effect thing here? If you've got migrant workers that enlarge the pool of potential employees, is that keeping low pay down? Is low pay associated with migrant workers not necessarily full-blown justice, but simply they are perhaps not as demanding, or you know, they're more accepting, again, if you look at relative incomes here as compared to the countries that they come from, what seems a low-pay culture here may actually be significantly better than the options in their countries of origin. So is it simply a coincidence that you've got an industry that has both low pay and migrant workers, or is there a causal relationship? I think that's the way I would try to see what I'm getting at on that.
Yes, I think there's both going on, and I'll try to explain what I mean by that. But firstly, I want to say that, you know, so there's actually, from what I can see, relatively little evidence and research out there trying to sort of understand, you know, particularly sort of the core of your comment in question, and so we're a little bit in the dark. That's why those two studies I highlighted are very important, I think, especially the Joseph Rowntree Foundation one. I think has a lot of insights in that study. But I think the thing you have to understand is that there is, you know, the way it's sold to when I've read these reports, the way it's sold to a lot of migrants is the dream, you know, come here, there's work, better income, and you see that also in the interviews with migrant workers, and they can then give, you know, send money back or even go back. But we also have, there's another side to this, is that companies in these sectors actively recruit in these countries, and so they just by chance I was having to be sitting next to somebody from a meat company, and he was telling people about how they now have got a recruitment agency out in Bulgaria to find the workforce for a new plant they're opening in the UK. So it's not just, you know, they're called the part, that's a sort of another missing part, I think, in the sense of that we forget that businesses are proactive here. It's not that migrants are come over and say, what job can I get? You know, there's a sort of a method and a means.
But you're also getting that a little bit in, I mean, not my specialist subject at all, but I'm aware of stories that you get similar thing in the health service. People are going recruiting.
Yeah.
And it's not just necessarily the low skilled. I mean, nurses, even doctors, because we are not producing the people with the skills to meet the demand. So to keep up staffing levels, you know, NHS trusts or whatever are actually going out and recruiting in exactly that same way.
Yes.
So, you know, I think you touched on a point. Are some of these features unique to the food sector, or are they reflected in other non-food areas as well?
Yeah. I think the point I was making was that they are reflected in, there's a sort of, a fundamental structural problem that affects other sort of industry sectors as well. But also I was trying to understand, are there unique features within the food sector? And in some areas it seems that the food sector, exploits this type of labour more than in perhaps other industry sectors. But it is a fundamental problem in the food industry. You know, the food industry trade bodies themselves, do recognise that they have all sorts of skills problems at the high end, as well as, sort of getting people to work, at the more entry level positions. So, but they don't seem to recruit so much, sort of from the high end skills, sort of from other countries.
I mean, I won't hold the question, but just anecdotally on that, I used to work for the Food and Drink Federation.
Yeah.
And they started up lots of apprenticeship and a degree in food engineering and so on. But I've spoken to people in companies who say that what they wanted, British system is producing some engineers, not enough, but not engineers who can walk onto a factory floor and immediately engage with the food industry, whereas a Czech engineering graduate, for example, will actually be trained in the specific technology.
Yes.
So if you're opening a plant, rather than have to train somebody in your specialism before they become effective, if you can just go and recruit, and that's not a low pay thing, that's a skill.
It is. Yeah.
That's a skill issue.
Yeah, but that's something that the food industry recognises. You know, they see that as a recruitment problem. They call it, you know, the upskill problem. And that's an issue that comes out again and again about, you know, people not having the skills or the attributes they're looking for in the workplace from British workers.
I wonder if, from the floor, if there are things you would like to add on this issue around low pay and migrants, since this is a particular issue in this area. So maybe some contributions that you... Yes, sir. And there's then a gentle at the back. And then the lady...
The level of concern, having met with the gang masters a little while ago with the council, one thing that concerns me is that if there is obviously problems in the reduction in the number of gangmaster personnel that are available, and it was noticeable when we met with him that he has to cover a very large area. I think if there are problems, as we've talked about today, then I think rather than a decrease in staffing and personnel and budgeting, there ought to be an increase, because, you know, you can only be in one place at a time, and if you're at opposite ends of your region, then you're not going to be able to deal with it in the way, not through any fault of your own, but the sheer pressure of time and work. And I think that is an area of concern, that if there are issues, particularly migrant workers and things like that, that there ought to be an increase in the budget rather than a decrease.
Yeah, so it's about enforcing what is already on statute and having the capacity to do that. Gentleman at the back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like all markets, like everything to do with the labour market, migration, it's incredibly complicated. You've got to be very careful when you start trying to sort of intervene to change things, because you don't know what the long-term outcome is likely to be in terms of the availability, for example, of local employers to get the employees that they need. And I'm sorry I missed the first part of the presentation, because you may have covered this. But I think, fundamentally, the major problem you've got in Boston is you've got the prevalence of zero-hours contracts. And zero-hours contracts are something which seriously needs to be addressed by government. Zero-hours contracts are great for an employer, because you can get as many people on the books as you need. You don't necessarily have to offer them work. But they also, I think paradoxically, operate to do exactly what you described earlier on. They act as the kind of incentive to come over to this country, to come over to this town, for example, on the speculative hope that having arrived here, you know, you might actually find yourself some employment. And when those opportunities are taken up by people, what tends to happen is they either get a couple of days' work here or there, or they don't. And when they don't, they tend to end up being recipients of, you know, charitable welfare and that sort of thing, often homeless. Often they fall into that category of the exploited. But it's really the system that exists that not only exploits them, but encourages them to come without the prospect of any permanent sort of, you know, justifiable employment. And I think, you know, we need to do something about that. My view is that you can intervene at a governmental level with zero-hours contracts and not adversely affect the overall functioning of the labour market.
When you say intervene, do you mean abolish zero-hours contracts?
I personally believe that zero-hours contracts should be abolished, and I wouldn't want to put a limit on it, but I think you should have defined hours contracts. And even if the defined hours contracts is 5 hours, you know that you're entitled to that contract, and I think it will stop people taking a punt on coming over here on the basis they might end up with 20 hours, but they only end up with 12.
Right, and too specific. I mean, you've made a specific point about the 0 hours contracts. On the other point you're making, do you have evidence of that, or is that your feeling?
What's that?
Yeah, that people are coming over here because of the 0 hours contracts.
The gangmasters and the labour suppliers want to have more people on the books than they need, because that way they've always got somebody they can deploy when, you know, a local food producer phones up and says, I've got a contract from Asda, I need 100 workers tomorrow, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. They've always got the bodies on the books that they can phone up and get into work. It's complicated. I think there's speculation involved. I think there's a pull element in the fact that local labour suppliers want people in huge quantities, so they've got that level of flexibility. But I think if you got away from the zero-hours contract and you had a defined hour contract, it would deal with both sides of that labour market equation, if you like.
Okay, thank you. The lady at the front.
Hello. Really enjoyed both the presentations, and I can see a lot of synergy between the issues that we've got in Boston, Lincolnshire, with the Tradecraft presentation. You mentioned that one of the differences between overseas and the UK is the fact that there's the protections. Unfortunately, some of those systems are changing and are impacting. The changes to the benefit rules for migrant workers has had an impact, certainly we've seen on a number of our clients.
Could you be specific about
that? Yeah, the changes that happened early part of last year, but there have been more and more sort of elements being added to it. There's a minimum amount of work that they should be working before they're then entitled to job seekers when that work dries up. But it doesn't just affect those that are new arrivals into this country since 2014. It affects everybody that is a migrant worker. So we've had four families that we've worked with since January the 1st this year that have been living in the area for some time. They worked significant amount of hours for 6 weeks on, say, for example, on the run up to Christmas, so the food being needed for Christmas. That work has now dried up, and whereas before they would be able to go on to Job Seekers Allowance and get that income coming in, they hadn't worked enough or earned enough over the preceding 13 weeks to be able to be entitled to benefits. And where we're seeing it is that then has an impact on their housing costs and their living costs, because not having access to Job Seekers Allowance then means they don't have access to housing benefit, and so therefore they're now having to find full rent on a property, £100 a week, and if they're only getting one day's work, gentlemen, you introduced me to last week at the food bank, he had that, he was working practically full time plus for 6 weeks on the lead up to Christmas. He's now only guaranteed one, maybe 2 days a week work. Because of that, he's not entitled to any benefits. Puts his house at risk. Family obviously is going without food. We're signposting to organisations such as Ian's Food Bank. So whilst the systems are in place, they aren't protecting the workforce because they have that impact.
The lady behind you, and then the gentleman in front, then I'll go back to the commissioners. Okay.
Yes, I can just add to that, you know, that there is, I'm CEO of a homelessness charity, and we see in excess of 50 homeless people a month, of which about 80 to 90% are migrants who have come here. Many of them originally did have housing because they had a job and they got housing which was tied into their job. They lose that. They now, in most cases, cannot get housing benefit, which means that they're not going to be eligible for any sort of housing, and they find themselves either sleeping rough or sofa surfing and that sort of thing. And of course, once they find themselves in that situation, it is much harder for them to get back into work because their mental health and physical health tends to suffer, so they actually become less employable. And they are signed up with these agencies, but they're often going to be the last ones that get the phone call. They're desperate for their phone to ring, but they're often just getting a day's work here and a day's work there. And that's not, it doesn't provide enough income for them to hold down any accommodation. A lot of them will, they like to try and rent a room in a house. That's the most basic form of accommodation, but a lot of them can't even afford that. And then that does lead on to other problems such as antisocial behaviour and that sort of thing, as many of the people in the room will appreciate.
Gentleman at the front.
Yeah, I just touched on some of the issues raised, but this sort of access to justice is interesting, with the GLA having their budget cut. You've now got things like, there was an introduced, I think it was in April 2013, you have to have a 2-year period, you can just be dismissed without any reason. Now, we're going to from 1 year. That's a reduction in justice. Whether you like it or not, there we are. You now have to pay for workforce tribunals. So if an agency or anybody who withholds your holiday pay, what's the point? We have a lot of people coming through our books with that, you know. They've withdrawn the holiday pay. You can take it for workforce, but it'll cost you £200 and some to start with. There's no point, it's only £160 anyway. you know, zero-hour contracts. You can't have two zero-hour contracts with two different agencies, because if they find out, you'll get no work. There's some really appalling employment practice in the area where we are at the moment. And does that come from the fact that employers will only employ people who are prepared to work long hours, or the fact that they're being pressured by the food system to break things as cheaply as possible? So somebody's making a lot of money somewhere along the system that actually forces them in that position. I don't know what the answer is to that, but that's a fairly fundamental question to me. If it's chicken and egg scenario, you could argue, bringing the point, you know, is it migrant workers, low wages, etc. within the Boston area? You know, we've still got roughly the same unemployment figures 10 years on that were 10 years ago, and yet we've had an increase in population, a fairly dramatic increase in population, and yet the unemployment figures are the same. Does that mean that those jobs were created in the area? And if they were, why was that investment put into the area? There's some questions around that. Where does that come from? Because actually, if those jobs were created, then did we actually have the local employment or local resource to actually fill those jobs if those were created over that period? Because if there weren't any jobs created, you would expect that 10,000 increase in population is going to make a massive increase in unemployment. And again, there's some questions around that to actually sort of get into those sort of things. I think one of the things I would also say from the low wages economy, it's not just a low wage economy locally, it's the inconsistency of income is hitting people dramatically, as was raised by Katie. If you know that you're going to get a low wage all the time, it's easier to manage than if that low wage is disappearing for periods and coming back and disappearing. Really difficult to manage for people on that basis.
Yeah. Gentleman behind you, and then the guy at the back, and then someone from the commission, if someone else would like to come in, Neil, or, sorry, Jeanette, or Sue or John after. Sir?
Because we run a tick box system of referral, we're finding that increasingly we're getting people referred to us who, as already been said, are on low incomes. And of course, you need to bear in mind that although initially we only issued three amounts of food, we had to extend that.
So you're a trussell-truss model? Basically,
a trust model.
Yeah, because there are different models of food.
We don't need to necessarily drive in the same lane. we often find that we need to extend that and do so willingly. There is another issue too, is that a lot of the people who are on low incomes, if they are living in poverty, have to pay their utility bills, gas and electricity, on these prepayment systems, and having just renegotiated my own home tariff, those sort of things are not available to people like that. There is a high markup.
We've had strong evidence about that in earlier hearings, and,
yeah,
and the kind of poverty premium that is charged.
It needs to be laid alongside the fact that people are, you know, having to face low incomes, and we are willingly having to extend the period of food support.
Yeah. Gentleman at the back wanted to...
Yeah, I want to pick on Stuart's point, actually. It was a good point that was made about the number of people and the levels of unemployment. I mean, I think what we've got in Boston is huge amounts of underemployment. And in the sense that people are working, as has been pointed out by one or two of the speakers, 2, 3, 4 days. For those people who can hit the magic 3 days, then they are entitled to in-work benefits. And so many of their problems in terms of housing, etc., will just disappear. But there's a massive number of people who fall into that highly casualised element of the labour market. And they're the people that everybody in this room probably has to deal with from time to time, because they're the ones who find themselves homeless, they're the ones who find themselves, you know, needing benefits and things. The problem with all of this is none of this stuff is actually illegal as such. It falls into the category of immoral. It's an immoral way to treat people, to have them on the end of the telephone, waiting around for that phone call. Many of the people who are in that category are the ones who come across here with mental health problems or alcohol-related problems, who the employers don't actually want, but once they're here, they can't go back. You know, it's labour... I'm a conservative. It's labour market misfiring. It's labour market malfunctioning. And something has to be done about making the labour market work. And that, I'm afraid, has to be the GLA. And the government has to be shamed into reducing funding to the GLA. You know, the GLA has got to sort out the labour market in relation to the people that we're working with, we're talking about. and take away that element of immoral practice.
Thanks. Was anyone else from the Commission like to put in some questions to our evidence givers, or maybe to the audience as well? So,
I've got a question to Michael. You referred in your presentation to a reduction of 17% in staffing working levels, did you?
No, I sort of I got a bit sort of tongue-tied in the point I was making.
Yeah.
What we were saying was that the agencies that were supplying labour to meat and poultry processors, 70% of that labour was migrant labour.
No, I think you're on the 17. I think you did refer to a 17%
yeah. reduction 17,
sorry, 17. In employment in food manufacturing.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Between 2000 and 2010, I think DEFRA Statistics, it's the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, for food and drink manufacturing, the total number of employees has gone down by 17% over that 10-year period.
And some of that is the result of automation.
Yes, yeah. Because that's the other thing. You know, when I talk about the more structural issues, it's about the introduction of new technologies, automation, different types
that
of...
That was going to be my question.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay.
Thanks. Any other comments? John?
I'm just wondering if we could tease out a bit more about the employment market. And we've had a few insights into the sort of migrant part of the equation. And I'm just wondering from local experience, I mean, I think we heard last night that even in a sort of county like Lincolnshire, the number of jobs that are actually in agriculture is very small by comparison with other things. But Michael has described for us, I think, those conditions of work that make it unattractive. But I just wondered if people had got local knowledge about what local indigenous people feel about the work that's on offer and what whether they want to do it or not.
Jeanette, do you want to throw that in, and then I've got two people from the floor who wish to.
Mine's very similar.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether we do ourselves a disservice because I'm hearing migrants and I'm hearing UK, and I know because my son actually is low paid. And they struggle. They've just got a new baby, but he's just a little bit above the pace, so he can't get anything. And my new grandson is a week old today. And we help out where we can, so they're, I suppose, lucky in that way. So I say the first thing is are we doing a disservice, because there are UK residents who've been there a long, long time who are going through exactly the same issues. So I think we should, bear that in mind. The government likes quick wins. And so I want to ask you guys a question. What would you do as a quick win? Because the government's only in power for 5 years, usually. And I know from experience that everything's got to be quick. So what would you do to make a difference?
Right, thanks. So while you're all thinking of an answer to Jeanette's one, I'll take the two people who are going to want to respond to John's and the two together, and then maybe all of us. Thank you, sir. I think you were first. Descend instead then. Oh, go on. Well, let's start over there. He's had it.
The quick wins is difficult. I mean, the question, sorry, I forgot your name, the former director of public health asked, was pretty similar to the one that you posed yourself in terms of what is a decent job. And I mean, that's a really deep philosophical question, because my view is I'm local, I work here, and I've now got probably what we'd call a decent job, a decent education, I was lucky, right place, right time, etc. But in terms of the concept of some of the challenges around here, picking up on, is there a difference between the migrant community and the indigenous community? For years, as a nation, we have told children and young people they need to aspire to a degree. So actually, for me, a decent job in the mindset of the majority of Indigenous people isn't cutting collies at minus five in January in a Lincolnshire field. It isn't stacking shelves in Asda. What we've done is we've nationally raised expectations to such a level, and to use a quote that's not mine, relegated local Indigenous people to the subs bench in terms of competing for jobs. Because I'm an employer in the local authority, and when I recruit, if I need an environmental health officer, yes, I need a skill set to allow them to practice, but more importantly, I want effort, enthusiasm and commitment. I'm also chair of a primary academy, and what I say to my head teacher is, I get the national curriculum, I get all of that, but I want to be turning out children who leave me with effort, enthusiasm and commitment, and that actually your life goal is to work, and cutting collies in Lincolnshire is a good job. We come back to the pay issue, and that's down, but one of the huge challenges is we're not engendering effort, enthusiasm and commitment. We're still setting the bar and the aspiration too high. It links to what yourself said, sir, in relation to migrants will come from Eastern Europe to Boston, who initially came as single individuals to earn what was a good wage cutting collies in Lincolnshire to send back. We've now got a much different dynamic because we've got families living here, and actually, on balance, a lot of migrant communities, I know from my own research of data I hold within the organisation, there's an awful lot that are taking 2/3 of their income and living costs are met by in-work benefits as opposed to earned income. So we really have skewed the employment market by relegating our Indigenous community to this position and importing. We've never actually had a shortage of labour in Boston. That's a bit of a misnomer. We used to just bus it in from Sheffield, Bolton, the coalfields in white vans in the 70s and 80s. And I remember working in a pack house myself as a student when somebody tapped me on the shoulder and I was the only person left in the pack house, because at the time it was the DHSS who were doing the raid to see if you were working and claiming. And clearly, as I was the only one left as a student whose national insurance number was registered, the answer to that was probably yes, they were. So it's the same, you know, we have a demand for labour that we've never been able to satisfy locally. It's just that some of the ambition for that is very different now. Because I bet most people, if we're honest, and asked, if I asked you to put your hands up, who would aspire for their children to work stacking shelves in Asda as a career rather than working up and ending up, you know, at MD level? We probably wouldn't in this room say that that was the case, all working on the field. So we need to just change our national mindset about work. Life is about working, effort, enthusiasm and commitment. That's all I would ever ask for.
Was there something else?
I'll come back now.
Yeah, I think so. Just coming back to the thing that we've had some interesting things in Boston itself. I mean, it's probably not anybody's surprise we've got the lowest average wages in Lincolnshire here. From my experience across at the Bureau, our average wage here is around about 19,500. We don't see people earning 19,500. And we're getting through about 6,000 people a year at the moment. So there's a huge gap between a lot of people must earn way more than that, a lot of people earn less than that. For instance, minimum wage is about 13,500 a year gross.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody else who can manage on that. I can't, but there you go. And we're about third lowest in the UK as well, so that's the sort of thing for our area. Linked to that, we've got the lowest unemployment, but I agree with Mike, but a lot of that is about part-time, temporary, seasonal. If you're on those, you're not classed as unemployed, yet you're not guaranteed income, which is another problem. And coming on to something probably we will do at some point, but I mentioned housing, we've got the highest rents in the East Midlands.
Yeah.
For instance, if you want a double room in a house in Boston at the moment, you're looking at around about £140 a week. That's scary, that, isn't it? Absolutely scary. So that's where we are. Quick wins. I don't think there are any quick wins because society doesn't change that quickly. And so what we do need, if you want a quick win, if we're going to help people through this process, we need the funding and the support for longer terms than the government seems to be prepared to put it in at the moment. Because it's all short term, give you it for 2 years, take it away, you should have sorted it. Society doesn't alter that quickly. People's behaviour doesn't alter that quickly. Attitudes take even longer. So we have to have a committed funding stream to allow the people on the ground here who do the jobs to actually be able to continue doing them for the people who have the problem. I'm just interested about the academic levels within some of the workforces locally. Some of the migrant labour workforce locally is very highly qualified, working on minimum wage pack house jobs. interesting if you actually look through it.
Right, let guy at the back, then lady at the front.
Yeah, just a couple of observations. I think, Mike, you've highlighted the impact of things like zero contract hours and other, if you like, legal employment practices that were having an impact on everybody where you know it falls on. But I think there was a difference between what the lady said about people who are suffering through employment practices and those who are being criminally exploited, and the ones who are vulnerable to being criminally exploited are migrant workers. But the complexity within the migrant workers is, and the dynamics is something else as well, and the predisposition of whether you're going to be exploited is a whole range of factors. I've been doing some training in factories, and I know there are employers and employees who will not have Romanian workers. They have said it quite candidly that they will not employ them under any circumstances. So there's a level of discrimination that starts even before they enter the workplace. If they do enter the workplace, they are treated as subhuman. They are not seen even by other migrant workers as being on the same level. Mm-hmm. And I think there's issues of exploitation by migrant worker or migrant worker. There's issues about people's level of qualifications, whether they speak English, the understanding of laws. All of these will influence to a degree the level and type of exploitation that people can suffer. But I think the difference, from my point of view, is we can all suffer inequalities, injustice, but I think when we're talking about criminal labour exploitation at its most extreme, where it involves violence, where it involves threats of violence, then there are people who are particularly vulnerable, and they tend to be migrant workers.
Thanks. Gentleman at the back.
Well, I just wanted to Andy gave a very good description of where the labour market malfunctions around the expectations that young people might have about the kind of work they want to do, and that is a big problem. But essentially all of the issues we're talking about are problems of markets malfunctioning, and I've made the point earlier that you've got to be very careful how you intervene in markets, because you don't want to sort of throw the baby out of the bathwater and make it malfunction even more than it malfunctions already. But certainly one thing that I'm particularly concerned about is the issue of in-work benefit availability. And I think it's absolutely wrong that supermarkets can drive down the price of food whilst simultaneously employing people whose wages are subsidised by the taxpayer. And that's a piece of market malfunctioning that needs sorting out. You should work for the wages that you're paid. There shouldn't be an expectation that you're going to get subsidised by the state, but neither should there be an expectation on the part of business that the government's going to come in and subsidise your workforce. This is crazy idea.
Can I pick up on some things then that we've heard and get your responses? In the background paper that Cameron prepared for us, he drew on a report that was actually in the bacon industry, but talked about the issues around supply agreements instead of contracts that are now being given to the pack houses and others and farmers and so on. And then also the kind of flexible supply agreements, which mean paying off suppliers one after the other, insisting on processors are paying for promotions, asking for basically, I'd call them bribes, to put your stuff on the shelves or whatever. Now, that is also about inconsistency of income. It's also about inconsistency. And yet that has become, it seems, normal business practice. And so we're actually saying what seems to have become normal business practice is a core of this problem, which you're saying to me in different ways, and it's having very bad effects on people who are working for difficult, and it's actually having very bad on the people who are actually growing. And someone was saying to us both last night and this morning, you know, I'm having trouble selling my potatoes at £60 a tonne, and they go for £2,000 plus a tonne if you go and buy them in the supermarket. Where's the money going in between and all this? And so there's a set of issues around there. And that then is linked to the whole way we've got this just-in-time manufacturing. So we're all taking it as normal that it's fair enough you should ring up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, I want 100 workers at 4 o'clock. And that's the way it is. Should that? That wasn't the way it was. It's become the way it is. So I'm interested in kind of some of your reflections. We are trying to juggle with quite a lot in this report, because we're trying to get at, you know, food banks and the people you are helping in urgent need seem to us a tip of an iceberg. And that's why we haven't called this a Commission on Food Poverty. It's about food and poverty, because it goes much deeper than the tip. And many people won't go to a food bank because of shame, or, you know, you know that, you're nodding your heads. So we're trying to get kind of at those issues. And you've also mentioned, and we didn't mention very much the Agricultural Wages Board. I'd be interested to know if you have any views on if the abolition of that has had anything. You seem very strong in saying that in where we are now with what has become normal business practice, we actually need really strong legal clout to stop it becoming even more exploitative than it is, because there's a lot of criminal activity going on, and the people who are doing that are actually having their budgets cut, and that's an issue we should be looking at and highlighting. But then there's a question of, should they be going out to recruit there initially? But what you're saying is, actually it used to be Sheffield, now it's Romania and Latvia and so on. That's basically the point I'm taking out from you. The 0 hours contracts is clearly a very big issue, and we need to look at that. So those are the few thoughts, just trying to listen to you and pull out some of the things from. And I think the other question is, what about fair trade for everybody? And we've had you were all nodding your heads as Fiona was talking, it seemed to me, about, and thinking, well, that seems relevant for here as well. Yeah. And so I think that was quite an interesting watching your reactions to that. A few thoughts to put in, and we've got about 15 minutes left for further inputs and comments from the floor and from the commissioners. And I see two hands up already. I'll go to the lady first, then you.
Just building on what Andy was saying and what Lenny was saying about the Indigenous population. We work with social housing tenants. There's a very small proportion of local of social housing tenants that are actually migrant workers. One of the areas we work with is those that are on 0 hour contracts. We are an ageing population around here, so we do see a lot of people going into the care sector, which has the same issues in terms of very low pay, low qualifications, but is low income. And a lot of our Indigenous population are very savvy in terms of what they're entitled to. So it's the encouragements, the incentives to go into work, and that's where Andy's wanting the effort and the enthusiasm is the issues, because why should they? Because they're going to be getting the same if they don't. And that's what we find from our Indigenous population, in Indigenous UK residents that we work with as part of our project, is that the encouragement to work isn't there. But those that are wanting to work are working in low-paid sectors such as care and agriculture.
School meals.
But the enthusiasm for those that are working, they are wanting to work and better themselves, but get knocked down with the other things that they then become not entitled to because they are working.
Yeah, I'll ask you something about universal credit afterwards, sir, and then the guy.
I mean, I was just going to make a bit of a confession, really, because part of the problem is me as a consumer, because I'm a price-conscious consumer, and in my local community, most consumers are price-conscious. So as soon as bananas get a £3 a kilo, we stop eating them, and then you have to do your residual residual value calculation as to how much gets down to the bottom of the supply chain. I mean, in all of that you sort of summed up, I mean, I've written some questions down as to how do we break it. It does become the norm, and that identification of the bottlenecks is really interesting. In terms of corporate social responsibility, it's not driven by industry. It's another regulatory code that's done in the large players subscribe to try and gain and secure competitive advantage and purchases me, the consumer, through. I suppose that, you know, the grocery code adjudicator, who's actually going to pay the fines when they're levied? Because it won't be Tesco, so it will be in year, which will be a write-off against corporation tax, but actually it'll go down the supply chain. So I don't have any of the answers. Like a lot of people in here, I've just got a whole host of questions that probably aren't that helpful. The thing that we've lost as consumers is the emotional connection, because we see, you know, Apple. I'm sure most people saw the Apple, you know, the controversy over how they were treating their workers. I have to say, my emotional connection was greater with the iPhone 6 because I just bought one than I'm afraid it was with the workers. And that's the thing, we've lost that emotional connection with the entire supply chain. I don't know how we get that back, but that, if we do, that will address that list of things you've picked up from us as an audience and fellow commissioners.
Again, it's more of a question than any comment, but I think one of the questions we can ask ourselves is, when does a migrant worker simply become a Boston resident? Who's got the same issues as anybody else? It's just one of those concepts within society as well, is when do we just accept them as people living and working here? You know, we've got a very settled population who happen to have come from Poland. I'm a migrant, I came from Sheffield, I did a bit on the farms, pea picking, but I was never put out for that work. But it is about, when do we see them as residents and part of the community, and who have just got a simply different background?
Yeah, sorry, the guy at the back then, Andrew.
Well, I just want to make a comment. I know we've been doing a lot of talking, I will shut up. We've talked rather a lot. But I just think, you know, it's always very easy, I think, to become sort of a bit ideological about subjects of this sort, and to sort of think that, well, you know, we've got to sort of be able to champion the work, and we've got to do everything to sort of, you know, tackle business. But in relation to the point that Andy's raised about employment, and particularly the employment of young people, I think it's really critical. You know, we defer young people going into employment now for a further 2 years. There was a time when you went into work at 15, and the expectation was, if you hadn't got qualifications, you just have to take a job. Nobody. When I was a county councillor 3 years ago, and I remember raising this particular topic at a children's scrutiny committee meeting, and saying, well, they should, you know, really young people should be getting into work rather than having their expectations raised and their entry to the labour market deferred for 3 or 4 years. And it was met with absolute horror. Absolute horror. I could have said something about, you know, doing some harm to people rather than actually making what I consider to be a fairly sensible suggestion about young people getting that enthusiasm, that motivation, that desire to earn, that desire to make a contribution, rather than having it deferred and deferred. I mean, I've got a son who's just come back from university with an economics degree. And before he went, he worked for KFC, and he's come back to Boston. He's just been teaching outside, and he didn't enjoy it. He came back after 6 months. And he said, what are you going to do for a living? I said, well, you know, why don't you go back to KFC? Anybody would have said, I've told him to go and boil his head or something. Oh, I can't go back there. You know, I've got blah, 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 blah. There is this real problem today that people don't actually see that they've got to earn their own income. They see that an income is their entitled to an income, but they haven't actually got to go out there and work for it. And I know it sounds ideological, but I think, you know, we need to get people back into the mindset where, you know, the first person that they are responsible for is themselves, and the last person the government's responsible for perhaps is them. And that's a really unfashionable thing to say. But I think until we start to accept that, I don't think we're going to solve all of the problems that we're talking about this afternoon.
Fiona.
I'm just sort of mindful of the time and sort of been jotting down ideas in case they're...
Yeah,
they're useful.
Well, you and Michael can throw those back at us now.
Essentially, I feel that there's solidarity in the problems, essentially, between workers overseas and workers here. And the conversation about migrant workers is really interesting, because also we've got the people in the Thai fishing sector are trafficked from Burma. The people working in cocoa are trafficked from the poorer countries, which are Burkina Faso and Mali. So I feel that what we need to do is to think about protecting the bottom, And so fair trade is structured to protect a particular labour-intensive part of the supply chain. That's how fair trade is structured. So I think there's that to think about. In terms of some practical things, I think that the Equalities and Human Rights Commission should have greater enforcement powers. They've got enforcement powers on discrimination, but not in relation to human rights. It was very weak what they were able to do following up from the Meakin Poultry investigation. We've got the modern day slavery bill going through at the moment. We've got amendments coming out on Monday. Key organisations have asked for the GLA to have greater money to protect people. It's worth banging that drum while that particular piece of legislation is going through now. And the other component is, so there's one side which is enforcement, but I'm very keen on prevention and doing things that could stop these things happening. And a key component, which perhaps Sue and other trade union colleagues might have views on, is for those companies that claim that they are treating people well in the supply chain, I would want them to see them disclose supply chain locations, factory sites. If they disclose factory sites, the benefits are that should you go onto a site, you could see whether or not it does meet what they claim they are doing in their code of conduct. But also the benefit is that it enables worker and community organisations overseas to know that they don't just have national law to go to, but they might be able to get some change out of the international supply chain. So disclosure of actual supply chain locations needs to be a component, and it's up for grabs on that particular piece of legislation. Because effectively, all of us here have agency. We can go to work, but we can also say, oi, this isn't right. And we've got these bizarre situations where we've got these companies at the top saying, oh, well, we give good working conditions to everyone in our supply chain. But where do they give the agency to these workers that they are, in theory, got codes of conduct to protect? They don't. They don't give the space for the worker to actually voice that they are not being treated according to the code of conduct. So that's something to think about. I think we have to think about enforcement. If it is very profitable, it continues. Leading companies tell us they cannot put certain products on the shelf according to good practices because basically they're undermined by laggard companies. Yeah? Laggard companies.
Can you explain that to me? I don't understand.
Yeah. So this is most obvious in mass market garments.
Right.
So you've got, well, it's true to also actually for tea. If you were to think about tea bags, some tea bags are on at a price that I cannot understand how they got there. That then limits what you pay for the mass market higher end. And we are still struggling in tea to pay a living wage. So when you ask people, why are you not paying a living wage at this price? They say the price points that we put this on can't be that far off the value price. But if you actually do the calculations on those value tea bags, I don't know how they got there. So basically what I'm saying is it is extremely profitable to exploit people. It's blindingly obvious. And so we need to be thinking about enforcement that is of sufficient scale with deterrent sanctions to address that. I mentioned before that it is unfashionable to look at buyer power, but we must look at buyer power, not supplier power. I wanted to make a comment about flexible. The consequences of flexible are problematic in many, many, many areas. Flexible has got a problem for waste. Got a problem for human beings. What I also do not see in the international supply chains is an analysis of what is your base volume that you are providing. For your everyday base volume, you should be able to employ people on permanent contracts for that base volume. And you should be able to evaluate, based on your previous experience, approximately what is the fluctuation over and above that. then you employ your temporary workers on that aspect. But what we're seeing is people are put on flexible contracts for the whole lot. And the other thing that's really interesting when you talk to retailers is they are very keen on their promotions. But as a consumer, if I choose to buy broccoli, I am unlikely to buy spinach because it's one meal. I don't do an and, yeah? So if you've got broccoli on promotion, that will have consequences maybe for the other green vegetables. I'm just giving an example, yeah? The supermarkets do not include that, nor do they communicate it to their suppliers. I understand why they don't do it, but it's got totally predictable outcomes for the amount of volume that you need throughout the whole of the supply chain. And I know of people who are asked to plant seeds in the ground. They expect to be able to sell a certain number of kilograms, and they're completely dumped on. And I'm sure that's happening here. That's what was also explained to me. Now, some of that could be predicted and communicated with proper planning. Retailer down to supplier, they choose not to do it. But we need something that changes behaviour, and hopefully, fingers crossed, the supermarket's adjudicator, the groceries code adjudicator might do it. Fingers crossed.
Thanks, Michael. You've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Well, I'm going to...
Because we have to go.
Yeah, I'm going to sort of stick to clichés then. Because I think, you know, one of the key things is to create some sort of level playing field, and that does take a regulatory and enforcement. Because it seems, and for me, in the food sector, what concerns me a lot is the growth of these agencies and how they work and operate. And part of the reason why they're so attractive is that somehow they're enabling mainstream companies to get out of their obligations to people who they have to employ directly. So it seems to be, it's a sort of, you know, perhaps incorrectly, but I might characterise that as a loophole that needs to sort of dealt with. So we need to sort of, that's what I mean by creating level playing fields. There shouldn't be, you know, sort of get outs of people. I'm doubtful about grocery adjudicator in terms of fines. I think that is important as well, but, you know, we've seen with the banking system, the banks, however big the fines, virtually no difference whatsoever. I also think that, you know, to me, it's also this moral compass, losing that. How can we sort of, you know, start to initiate, you know, a wider debate about, you know, what sort of society, what sort of work, what sort of values we want, and, you know, those soft factors. And in that sense, I think that, again, this is because this is deeply unfashionable, we should bring back into fashion. We should restart debates and the ability to talk openly and constructively about labour, workers and markets. You almost can't talk about that. You know, you can't even sort of put it on an agenda almost. Oh, what about workers, you know, or working conditions or labour? It's very, very difficult to sort of bring that up, you know, seen as something from the 70s. And my final point is also, you know, we are talking about, you know, work and business, you know, go together. You know, there's issues around the way in which businesses are performing or not performing, particularly in the food sector. And I think we need to look at perhaps the lack of innovation, about sort of how they're driving their costs out, how that, you know, we're not sort of investing in our businesses, and that's why I put part of the structure up is that most, you know, food companies are small scale companies. And they're the people who employ people. The big companies through technologies are sort of laying, you know, sort of downsizing. So there's we could sort of look at segments and regions and how to target for best effect.
Right. Look, thank you all very much for coming today. We have to go off because we're going to go and visit a pack house actually shortly. We will be delighted to send you the interim report. We'd be delighted to have specific evidence if you wish to submit it. On the website for the foodandpoverty.org.uk, there's a way of submitting it, and there's Cameron at the back. Wave, Cameron. You can send it by email to him. And I'm sure, I trust, if through Alan, if we have your emails, you'll be on the mailing list for the interim. And thank you so much indeed for coming and spending your time today.
Thank you.